You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Our episode is brought to you today by Harry's. Harry's, H-A-R-R-Y-S, not, you know, Harry's as in I'm Harry. Although, this is a company that sells quality shaving material and gives you a quality shaving experience. I have personally used the product myself. It's outstanding. And it was started by the owner, who also started Warby Parker, whose sunglasses I am wearing as we speak. It's actually a lie. I'm holding them in my hand. It's too dark in here as I record. The point is that the guy makes excellent, excellent product for way cheaper than other brands. I think it's literally like 25% less, you know, than the leading brands. I mean, it's a lot cheaper. And, you know, when you go to buy expensive razor blades, let's just take an example, like, say, Gillette, the Mach 3 or whatever it is, you've got to wait for the drugstore guy to come and open this, you know, this sort of safe where they keep all these razors, like they're bars of gold, because actually people steal them. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. He had the same experience, and he was like, there's got to be a better way. So basically, you can go to harrys.com, and if you use the promo code BCS, as in Brian Callen Show, you will save $5 off your first purchase. That's $5 more off than what Harry already gives you in comparison to the leading brands. I think it's worth it. I think it's a great company. I think they have a quality product. They actually bought the factory in Germany where they make the steel blades. I don't know what that means, but it sounds pretty cool to me. If the blades are made and they're tempered German steel or whatever it is, it just sounds, I don't know, like that's what I want on my face. I want some German steel on my face. Sorry to yell so loud, I just get kind of excited. So once again, go to harrys.com, use the promo code BCS to save $5 off your first purchase. Now let's get back to the Brian Callen Show. Ladies and gentlemen, the authors of Partners in Passion, A Guide to Great Sex, Emotional Intimacy, and Long-Term Love, Mark A. Michaels and Patricia Johnson, are on the podcast here. Read their book. Was ready, by the way, for your book to be, how should I put it? A lot of hippie, kind of drippy, kind of, I was like, all right, well, here goes this, that, and the other thing. You know, everybody writes a book. The fact of the matter is, I found it very intriguing for a lot of reasons we'll get into. You guys have been together for 15 years. You still have great sex. You travel. You've written books together. That's a real partnership, and that speaks for itself. That's a very difficult thing to do. It sounds like you're still in a vibrant, you know, partnership here.
Yeah, well, we practice virtually everything that's in Partners in Passion. We've had to.
When you're writing together, it's like everything is on the line. Your ego is out there, you know. All
you're vulnerable.
So you got to take a lot of sex breaks. Man, we've been writing too much. Got to put this into practice immediately.
We have to plan it. I mean, you know, you.
Yeah.
It's surprising, but you're together constantly, and you have access to each other. It's really important to decide to have sex and actually put it on the calendar.
Well, you touch on the fact that when you start talking about your relationship in terms of we got to work on this relationship, a relationship is hard work, and you use a different word I really appreciated, which was think of there's an art to a relationship. You're creating something together. It's not when you start using words like work and even a contract or sort of, you know, those kinds of words can tend to connotate the wrong imagery. It's kind of drudgery. Whereas if you change your language and you think of things as here we are as a couple and we're trying to create a better connection or a more adventurous connection or a more fun connection. Now you're probably changing the way you look at the scope of the entire relationship, right?
That's what we hope. We feel like it's a whole new paradigm.
And you're framing it in positive terms, you know, much more than negative ones. I mean, the idea of working on your relationship, most people say that when it's like way too late and all of a sudden now we got to work on it instead of, you know, let's pay attention to it on a daily basis.
Yeah, and you also bring, you also talk about the fact that one of the myths you talk about is that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. Yes, they're very different, but there are a lot of similarities between men and women, right? I mean, you know, I mean, the idea that women don't like porn. I know from my own experience, there are plenty of perverted women out there, otherwise known as my type.
Yeah. Right. I'm more visual than Mark, and I tend to, like Porn Fridays a lot more. I'm like, yay! So.
Mark, God bless you, Mark. Good job. She was an opera singer, and now she's into porn.
She was into porn while she was still an opera singer.
I was going to say, this is a personal question. Have you ever broken into an aria when you're having an orgasm, or is that too much information?
Jeez, I don't know. I can be quite vocal. We don't have children, but we do have parrots, and they can start singing along. It's quite hilarious.
Come on, that's fantastic. We don't have children, we have parrots. Shut those parrots up! I can just see your neighbors in New York. But let's talk a little bit about the myths, man. I love these. That was the part of the book that's kind of what hooked me into this book. I think you have a list about 10 myths here. One is, the first myth is you need to find a soulmate.
Right.
And you hear that all the time, man. You hear it all the time. And the fact is, according to you guys, you know, you're compatible with a lot of different kind of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody said to us recently, and I think this is a much better way of thinking about it, soulmates aren't born, they're made. Mm. Really, your soulmate is someone that you have a relationship with, that you build this connection with. It's not like there's some ideal person out there for you, and if you don't find them, you can't have a good relationship.
You're roaming the world as half a person.
Yeah, exactly. You complete me. Right? All that bullshit that we fall into. That I've always suspected as being just, you know, a fabrication of, you know, good movie writing.
It's a really old myth.
Yeah, it is.
Actually.
It goes all the way back. Like you mentioned the symposium, which I, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's taken on a kind of new and weird form in 21st century American society. And I don't know, there's a few hundred books with the title soulmate, you know, with the word soulmate in the title. So
yeah.
It's really pervasive.
It's a real marketing thing.
Well, the thing, you know, I'm 47 years old and I'm married and for 6 years now with two kids. But people ask me for advice on relationships and I don't have it, man. I don't have any advice. And what's ambitious about this book is you basically are out to create a manual for it as best you can, right? I mean, because if you look at enough data and if you look at what hasn't worked, and then you take probably, I'm sure you use your own examples. I mean, being married being together for 15 years and keeping it vibrant, that you've got to have some of the answers, it seems.
Well, what we tried to do, you know, is actually kind of approach it from, and what your question implies, it to approach it from the perspective of what works rather than what doesn't.
Right.
And most books on relationships are written by therapists, and nothing against therapy, but they're dealing with, you know, everything that's gone wrong in people's lives.
Mm.
And so we've interviewed couples that have been together in many, you know,
long-term, vibrant.
Minimum was 5 years in the book.
Erotically charged. And what we found was, you know, really happy couples can have a wide variety of relationships, but their core skill sets are remarkably the same.
What do you mean by that? Expand on that.
Well,
they have really good communication. They know about connecting with one another non-verbally. They've built trust and goodwill. They tend to be empathic, but not overly, and not overly engaged with one another.
They have a sense of adventure. They're very curious. Are willing to learn yet more. They're happy with the relationship.
Yeah. So all these things you're saying are active. They're active processes, mm-hmm. active words. Because like the myth too is they lived happily ever after, right? A lot of our culture, a lot of our mythology is based around the idea that you find the soulmate and you walk off into the sunset. And I've always said, yeah, right. That's when the fucking work begins, bro. That's when gravity starts to take its toll and all the shit you have to deal with and the little details, the minutiae. That's when, you know, I had a dentist who'd been married for 20 years. And when I got married, you know what he said to me? It was the best advice. He said, listen, I'm going to tell you something. Learn how to fight. learn how to fight. There are certain things you don't want to do in a fight. You don't want to be, you don't want to insult the person. You don't want to create scars because they last. You don't want to build contempt. And you just use the word goodwill and trust. And doesn't that fall into that category? How do you guys fight? How do you manage your differences?
Well, I really love that you bring up the fighting, because there is this idea that good relationships have no conflict. And actually, studies show the exact opposite. Relationships that last deal with conflict, as long as that conflict doesn't break you apart.
So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the key things, and your dentist gave some very good advice, and I think a lot of couples fall into this trap. When they fight, it's not just about the issue that's in front of them. It's about 20 other things that have been held back.
Mm, right.
And so one thing that when you're fighting is that you have to strive to keep it on point and only address the problem that you're trying to deal with.
We have one really important fighting technique. This is how we fight. We begin with a timeout.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. So you just, like, take a minute. Let's not talk at all.
Right, and look into each other's eyes in silence.
Oh, forget it. Not a shot. I mean, you guys are disciplined. Are you kidding me? I'd be like, fuck you. You know?
Well, you know, sometimes it starts out with like a fuck you in the gaze. But
yeah.
You can say a lot with your eyes. But that melts. And what you want to do is be in harmony at some level before you start to verbalize or address an issue. Otherwise, it's the kiss of death. You're going to say something. You're going to harm one another. You're going to come away very hurt. Mm. And you really, this is a person you love. You just want to avoid that potential at all costs.
What about the difference in cultures? You know, my culture, really, I was raised all over the world, but really, I think the most influential culture was probably my mother's culture. She's Sicilian. And I think when you come from, if you're Italian, and my wife is more German and Swedish, that is a very different, they deal with conflict they usually either completely avoid it or walk away from it or clam up and it's not spoken about, which I don't think is healthy. I, on the other hand, used to love to be like, I'm going to go crazy for about 5 minutes and then I'll be completely fine. And what I realized is that was very upsetting to her. It didn't work. It would really, really affect her deeply because she wasn't used to that. I was just being dramatic. I just thought,
right,
I'm not that mad. I just want to talk about breaking all the windows and killing everybody. And, you know, I mean, it was my release. And then, of course, none of it mattered. I never stay mad for more than 5 minutes. She'd stay mad for a week. And what was really helpful was learning to actually do what you guys are talking about, which is when I would feel it, when we feel it getting escalating, we walk away from each other for a little while. We just walk away.
Interesting.
And let it cool down and then come back and talk about our points of view in a rational way.
Yeah, fighting styles are really important. There are people that are like long term that, you know, their fighting styles both are just the yell, get it out. And then there are people who, you know, have to leave the house and go for a long drive before they come back, you know. And if you understand that your partner has a different fighting style than yours, then you can, you know, calm yourself down and go, okay, they'll be back in 20, and then I can pick up my rant then.
And everybody has to sort of, you know, everybody's a little different, and culture certainly is an important component of it. But even if you're from similar cultures, you may have different styles. I think over time, as you get to know a person and you kind of, you sort of meet in the middle, or if you're doing well, you figure out, yeah, okay, this is going to work for me to leave the house for 20 minutes and come back and talk about it.
Mm.
We have different styles. I'm slow to anger, but when I get angry, I get very angry. But I also, you know, I always
She's giggling. She's giggling in the background.
No, I'm giggling because he always wants to talk about it. You know, he hurt my feelings and I want to talk. And in my head, I'm always like, can't we just have sex? Let's have sex.
God, that is fantastic. Mark, get it together, dude. I never want to talk. God, you're
See, men are from Venus and women are from Mars.
I was going to say, you are an evolved man. That's fantastic. Mark's probably wearing a wig right now. That's amazing. Yeah. Well, but you know, this is the other thing I want to ask you about. There's this idea that we're fed a lot of information I don't think works. For example, we have to trust each other 100%. There's no way my boyfriend or my girlfriend, my husband or wife would ever stray. Never. I don't think that's healthy. I think that you should always have a little uncertainty. At least it just keeps you on your toes. I think if you really are that trusting and there's zero threat from the outside world, doesn't it create complacency? Doesn't it create, you know, isn't that part of why some people stop having sex or trying?
Well, I'd frame it a little differently. I mean, I think that from our perspective, the fact that you're going to desire other people, whether or not you act on it, is something that couples and the kind of the pop culture generally doesn't acknowledge. And in reality, we're all going to feel those desires.
And we can never talk about them. I mean, look at TV. There's not one sitcom. There's not one TV show that I can think of where if a man, God forbid, a woman actually desires somebody else in a real way, I mean, has lustful thoughts about them. That guy's a bad guy in your TV show. He's the guy you end up paying. He's the guest star. He certainly is not the star of your ABC, Fox, or NBC sitcom. I can tell you that right now.
I think it's a great point. Yeah. And that's just inhuman.
It's inhuman.
I mean, we all, and you want your partner to be tapped into that erotic vibe and in their life. Mm. You benefit when they're turned on by all kinds of things in life.
Yeah, I'm a natural born swinger, but my wife's not. Just saying, did I say that out loud? How many people are listening to this podcast? Keep going.
Well, I think most people actually are.
Really? Really?
Well, you know, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the swing culture. I think, you know, in our research, we interviewed a lot of couples, and so the scenario generally is the guy's like, yeah, come on, honey, let's try it. They finally go to an event or a party, and then the woman goes, oh, my God, this is amazing. And then the guy is sort of going, whoa, wait, honey, wait, come back here, you know.
You can't put that genie back in the bottle. You're right, though. A lot of men are threatened by most relationships that I see are both parties are playing a role. Women are acting feminine, men are acting masculine. We take on these roles a lot of times, and maybe part of it's okay because you're creating a mystery around the relationship and things. So a man will tend to behave a little bit more in more of a masculine prototype, and women do the same thing. I think there is a place for role play in relationships, but you know, I've always admitted. I mean, I've had plenty of really good relationships where we've engaged in swing-like activities, and it didn't hurt the relationship. It was very, very erotic and awesome, but I think it was also because we entered into it together as a partnership. What got me, what turned me on, was watching my girl do something that would be considered forbidden, you know, and she was, and it got her going. I think that's what it was. I remember being shocked at my own sort of reaction to that, which was kind of this jealous outrage, but being really turned on at the same time.
Were you jealous or envious, though?
I don't know, probably both. It's all a blur, man. It's a blur.
But when done right, couples who choose erotic adventures, regardless of what type it is, if it looks monogamous or open or swinging on the outside, if it's mutually done, it serves to deepen your bond.
Boy, that is heretical. You know that. In American puritanical culture, you are a heretic, young lady.
Thank you. I proudly wear the title.
Yeah. But
you know, there's research on it that shows this is true, although it's not clear whether there's a lower divorce rate among people in open relationships. There's the self-reporting of satisfaction in the relationships is higher. Mm. And so whatever the popular mainstream culture says, that's been well-researched and is very well-documented. So,
you know what I think is when people think about open relationships or alternative relationships, they still go back into the wording and language of cheating, betrayal, affairs. And once you start using those words or thinking those thoughts, you're not sexually adventuring. You're just being an asshole, yeah. you know?
Yeah.
So.
But you're also kind of, I think part of the reason it's considered heretical is you're fighting along, you're probably, there has always been, the idea of straying has always carried with it negative connotations, probably in many ways because it was physically dangerous to both men and women before we came up with things like penicillin and amoxicillin and antibiotics that cured things like syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia.
Condoms.
Well, sure, sure. But yeah. back in the day, you didn't have condoms. It's interesting how those customs that have come to us because they were probably physically healthier, that those things die very hard, especially when they're ingrained in our religious traditions.
Well, what happens?
Well, there's a reality to STIs, and we do have to be careful even now. And you know, there's a antibiotic resistant gonorrhea that's spreading, so people really do have to be careful about that. But I'll say that, you know, go back to the Middle Ages, and you had carnival, you had various kinds of contexts where people could act out their sexuality outside of their relationship, and it was culturally acceptable. Mm. So there was a place for it,
right?
In old times, it's part of human nature to want that. And when I said before, you know, everybody's a swinger in some ways. That's what I'm saying. Almost all human beings both want to bond with another person and have variety.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our biology.
That makes a lot of sense. I certainly feel that way. And I wish people were more, I really wish people were more honest about that. But let me talk about myth five. Relationships and sex are about getting your needs met. Maybe I could say that better. Relationships and, one of the myths you say is relationships and sex are about getting your needs met. Why is that a myth?
Well, that's kind of the psychology therapy model, the talking it out and saying, I want you to fulfill my needs.
Yeah.
And we don't think that's very healthy.
If you think of what a need is, you need to breathe air, you need food and water, and you need shelter. Mm. And if you accuse your partner of not meeting your needs, you're kind of, you know, accusing them of slowly killing you or something on some level. And if you use different words like I want, I desire, this would be very nice, then there's this wiggle room, there's this freedom, and it's an invitation to your partner to come and, you know, join you and say, hey, let's work together and see, you know, what we can come up with.
Yeah, one feels like you're including the person, the other feels needy. I mean, no pun intended.
And demanding, right? And accusatory, because then if your partner doesn't, you know, if I say, I need you to take out the trash this morning, and she doesn't do it, she's failed me somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, they say there's a difference between an insult and a complaint. So when you say, you know, in a relationship, you fight. I can't remember. Gottman, I think, is the mm-hmm. And he said, you know, make sure that when you, it's okay to complain. Relationships, strong relationships that last a long time, the couples can complain. They can say, you know, I asked you to take the garbage out, now I have to do it. You know, as opposed to saying, you know, you're so lazy. I asked you to take out the garbage, and you're lazy. And that is what causes a scar, not mm-hmm. not the complaint, because now you're attacking somebody's character. And,
yeah.
Right. And it's probably the same kind of thing where, you know, what I need from you is, and immediately I'm ready to fight.
Right.
You know, I crouch. Right. I crouch. I'm ready. Bring it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, another one like that is, you know, you always or you never. And we've heard that a lot from couples that we've worked with.
Oh, you always and you never. Wow. Yeah. There it is.
Yeah.
And a real bad one in that score is you never touch me right.
Oh boy!
Well, it's
how do you make love like under those circumstances?
I've always been a great asker. Even in high school, I was like, "So what's this little button do here, man?" I mean, I really did. I learned, you know, how to, you know, that's why I'm legendary in bed.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you bring that up because we have talked to young women and said, "Hey, why don't you bring home Partners in Passion?" And they look at us and they say, "My boyfriend would be insulted."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, whoa, really? And there's this like a masculine current of And I think it's an
I know how to do it, and I don't need anybody to tell me.
That's right. Oh, my God. I talk about this in my stand-up, and it gets quiet in the room.
It gets
the whole room, because what I'll say, if I start talking about penis size, I say, look, dick size is about territory. We want to feel like we've been further up the road. Everybody else before me had a mushroom cap. The reason men climb Mount Everest is to put their flag up there. It's not for the viewers. It's just to say, I had my flag up there and you didn't, motherfucker. I win. And dick size is the exact same thing. I'm telling you. It's like, I've been further up the road. And if I find out somebody has been further up the road and she really liked it, I'll find another road to climb, you know, or another mountain to climb.
Wow. You know, we got posed a similar question like that recently. A woman raised her hand, and she said, why would a man want to be monogamous if he's figured out how to fit his penis in a woman and make her have an orgasm? Isn't he done with her and wants to move on to the next one?
No.
Yes.
She actually asked this.
Yes. This was at the Hustler store on Sunset. Yes.
Oh, boy.
Well, that would be the place to ask that question.
Yeah. And by the way,
one was just totally through us. It's like...
She's been dating the wrong men. Let's start with that. You know what I mean? I think that a lot of it is also, and I think women know this, men take sex very seriously. My joke, and it's kind of true, is there was the girl who wasn't even a good person. I moved her into my house because every time we'd have sex, she sounded like she was falling out of a building. And I just felt like a champion every time we'd be done. I was like, she'll never be the same. She may as well just go to a nunnery when I'm done with her. You know, it was that feeling of feeling like a king. And she was amazing. She was so appreciative. She was kind of like, it was almost like I told her one time, I said, you're like driving a Porsche. It's like, I feel like the other women are like trucks and you're like a Porsche because I touch you and you react. We have sex and you just light up. Whereas some women just need, you know, I guess women who are more honest, I don't know what it is, tend to be more, you know, some women just take more time. Their bodies are different or I'm different and they're used to something different or they need something different. But either way, the one thing a man doesn't want to hear a woman do in bed is laugh. You know, you don't want her going, you know, and then, you know, she's probably been with better.
Well, laughter sometimes can be good. I mean, that's not sure. Going too far. Here,
not mid thrust, please. I want you losing your breath
as opposed to laugh at. Right?
Exactly. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Maybe we should tell the fMRI story. I think that's relevant to this whole thing.
Let's talk about triggering. I've been in the fMRI machine three times, participating at Rutgers University's study of the female brain on orgasm.
Wow, wait a minute. Oh, wait, so what is fMRI?
It's
Functional magnetic resonance imaging. So she's got her head restrained. She's in this big... functional MRI machine.
Let me take my pants off. Hold on. keep going.
And the first time she did it, I was in the control room, and she had to raise her hand every time she had an orgasm.
Oh, this is great. Where was I? I ought to be a doctor. Keep going.
It was funny at the very end. It was partially funded by the Christopher Reeve Foundation. So they were studying, if you think about sexual stimulation, does the same part of your brain light up? And they're discovering, yes, it does. And at the end of the session, I had been in the fMRI, I was in there 2 hours. And at the end of it, they said, okay, now you can just give us just your free-for-all orgasm, just something. So I start working myself up, and I'm like thinking, okay, I'm on the beach, and it's not working. And then I think, okay, and I stumble into the gym and the locker room, and it's not working. And finally I go, okay, I'm in an fMRI machine, and there's people.
In a lab. Yeah.
With coats, and they want a document.
That's great. What's under
the
that
human
robe?
Human brain is awesome. You can eroticize anything.
Yes, you can.
But then we did the partnered version where she was in the machine and I had to stimulate her from the outside and just reach in because, you know, there's no – I mean, it's this huge machine with a tubular thing where they slide her in on a conveyor.
So you are wearing lead gloves, lead-lined gloves.
Oh, no. No metal at all is allowed in the room.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So, and we actually practiced at home on our massage table and tried to prepare, and it was so different from what we did in the quote dry run.
It's not so dry.
You guys are dedicated scientists. Keep going. Keep going.
So we go through this whole thing, and I'm right-handed, and I'm trying to reach. I had to be on her right side, and so I have to reach across.
And it's kind of pokey, pokey, pokey. It's not quite right.
I was going to say, talk about getting a cramp. Yeah.
And I pride myself on my skills, right?
Right.
Sure. But I'm feeling like this is not going well.
Right.
But finally, I figure out if I use my left hand and my thumb and kind of nice rest the rest
pat,
of my hand on her.
Pat of the thumb.
And so that finally worked, but
incredible. We did achieve something, but we were later asked to rank it, and I was like, maybe a 5, which is like so. I hate giving him that kind of rating because it never. It's always
well,
like,
your
well,
head,
we always
your
do
head
love
was
it.
Your head was restrained, and you were in a tube, for God's sake.
We couldn't look at each other. We couldn't, you know.
Right. And he had to reach over his body. I mean, come on. Can't reach
but
over
I was
your
thinking
body.
She was going to give me a 3. Right. And I was still bummed out that it was a 5.
50%. You still failed. depending, yeah. So what did the fMRI say? I mean, what did they learn about your
She's
you know?
Still her this Nan Weiss is her name. She's finishing up her doctorate thesis, and she's still putting up the data and still, you know, crunching all of it.
Yeah, she's still watching the video.
We've seen a picture of her brain on orgasm, but we don't really know what it means.
just a big cloud of red. Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. I am so horny right now. And now every time I drive by a hospital, I'm going to get a hard on. This is crazy. It's like Pavlov's dog, man. Amazing. Amazing. You guys are dedicated. You do work hard at this, I have to say. I mean, you know, I mean, God bless, you know.
Yeah, the research is tough.
Right. Yeah. Why is the sex in movies and TV and porn? Why is that not necessarily a good barometer or metric for your own sex?
Wow, right. Well, you know, the chase is glorified. Usually takes the whole time, the whole entire movie. And then when the sex happens, it's, geez, I wonder what the average time allowed on screen. It's probably less than 3 minutes, if that, right?
And then they wake up somehow, and she's wearing his shirt, and you know.
yeah. Well, art imitates life, because I've had a lot of girlfriends in the past were wearing my shirt the next day and posing in the window, and I'm like, all right, I'm not into romantic comedies, honey.
But right, porn stars. I mean, the porn industry. These guys are rock. They're like superstars. They're athletes. These guys train. They have abilities that are so beyond your average person, and to compare your ability to what they're doing is just not wise. It's like going out to play basketball and expect yourself to perform like a
You're in the NBA.
Well, Patricia, speak for yourself, but keep going.
Well, there's a lot of prep that goes on behind the scenes, right?
Right, of course.
And some of these positions are not designed for pleasure at all. They're designed for, you know, point of view, POV shot.
Camera shot, camera angles. Yeah.
And, you know, it's not all porn is showing bad sex. I mean, clearly sometimes you see stuff that people are really, you know, they're really enjoying themselves.
We actually have a cameo in a great porn series called Chemistry by Tristan Taramino.
Really? And you guys are you guys are acting in the movie.
Tristan is a friend of ours, and we actually made a couple of instructional films that are explicit, where we taught, we didn't perform in them, but we taught couples on camera how to do some tantric techniques.
You guys are
and
going
we were
to
out
hell.
In, but we're in LA, and Tristan was making her fourth in the Chemistry series, Chemistry 4.
The reality porn.
So she puts a group of porn stars in a house and just lets them have at it and film each other, and she films. So we visited the set, and she says, guys, I want you to teach them a class.
So we taught them a class on Tantra, and at the end we demonstrated energetic orgasm partnered, and it became this big theme in the film. So.
Well, you dedicate a lot of the book to the Tantra sex. Explain to us, I know a little bit about it, but
Well, and part part of what you said as well in the intro of the book is that you knew that if you wrote a book that explicitly had Tantra in the title or something like that, that most people would not want to buy that book. Hence the decision to call it Partners in Passion.
Yeah, we've written three other books that all have Tantra in the title and that are very specifically about Tantra, which is an Indian spiritual tradition that has a sexual component to it. And it's closely related to yoga, and it can get very esoteric. So we wanted to apply a lot of those principles in a way that would be accessible to people who might think Tantra's weird and out there and new agey.
Yeah.
Why Tantra? Why? It doesn't sound like you guys need Tantra.
That's the basis. We got together. We actually didn't date. We got together to practice sexual Tantra, and wow.
Mark, you sly son of a bitch.
Wait, what about me?
Well, exactly, Patricia, you're my kind of lady. I'm liking both of you guys. Hey, we're not going to date. Let's just practice some Tantra.
Well, we should tell the whole story, because you're sort of getting the cart before the horse.
Well, I want to know, because let me remind the listeners for a second, man. You guys have been together for 15 years, and you've written 4 books now, right? Writing a book together, you're spending a lot of time together. So that's what I'm, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Whatever you're doing seems to be working well. Tell us the story.
Well, so I had just taken a teacher training and came back to New York and was giving a lecture on Tantra.
And I saw that it was, happening, and I had always been interested in Tantra, so I decided to go, not knowing what to expect. And I sat down, and in walks Mark, and I'm like, yeah, right, Mr. Tantra teacher. I bet you just say that because you can't get laid, right?
did Mark have a ponytail at the time? Was he wearing a toga?
No, my hair was short then.
That's right. Yeah. Right. No, yeah. He's wearing a ponytail now.
Hippie! Were you instantly attracted to him, or did it take a second?
Oh, gosh. You know, sometimes I'm attracted to people, and I'm really slow. I guess that's, again, me like a guy. I don't realize until like 2-3 days later. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Were we?
Well, I was very nervous, and I was very much in like teacher mode, and so I wasn't thinking about hitting on anybody at all. What happened was I gave the talk, and someone I knew brought Patricia up and introduced her to me, and I said, "You look familiar. Do I know you from somewhere?" But it wasn't a line. It was totally just dead serious on my part. Because there was something very familiar about her.
But he gave his email address and invited people to write if they had questions. And I started, we started an email exchange. And it was really awesome to me because I was able to talk about the energetic aspects of sex that I felt was really important. You know, the stuff that happens beyond just your plumbing and your body, that's where the richness can happen.
That sounds like a woman speaking, by the way, because most men just don't talk that way, do they? I mean, really? Right? I mean, that's what
I do, but...
Yeah, you do. You teach Tantra sex, my friend.
But I also, from reading her emails, and we were actually on a listserv together, and I recognized her address, and I saw some of the things she'd written, and it was like, she knows as much as I do. I know more about the history and, information, but on that energetic level, there's nothing that I'm going to be able to teach her. So we're emailing back and forth, and finally she says, can we get together sometime?
We met over sushi, and I was like, gosh, what is going on here? Are you going to be my teacher? I'm like grappling with that concept.
Yeah, in other words, are we going to fuck or not? I mean, that's really what's going on.
Well, this is the best part of the story, I think, is that she says, well, are you going to be my teacher? And I said, I'm really sorry, but I don't think there's anything I can teach you.
That was like, oh, shoot. I was like, can we at least be friends?
Mark,
so I said,
Mark, well
why don't
done.
We explore it?
Pulling back a little, putting some salt on her tongue. Salt on her tongue hanging just out of reach with a glass of water. I mean, talk about a master. Keep going. I want to take your class, Mark Michaels.
So I said, why don't we explore this on a sexual level?
Now, for me, I was like, score, you know, yes.
Score.
Because at that time, there was all this popular stuff going on, the rules, that book, and the game, and, you know, people trying to relate by manipulating one another. And I'm sorry, that just will never lead to great sex.
I feel that way too, Patricia, because I read The Game, and I've met Neil Strauss, and he's a neat guy, actually, just a guy. I said, why'd you write the book? He goes, I was lonely. I just didn't want to be lonely. And I don't know if he was being dramatic when he said that, but it kind of moved me a little bit. But my problem with that book is exactly that. I just felt as though it was one side manipulating the other side. It was the one team trying to beat another team. It was really probably a bunch of very insecure men who didn't like women or had been traumatized or had their hearts broken or had been humiliated by women when they were younger, and now came up with a whole bunch of techniques and tricks to get women to have sex with them, and it was all one big lie. That was why. And look at the name of the book; it's called The Game.
Right, and the same on the rules side. It's basically the same deal, right? It's
another form of manipulation.
Yeah,
it's how to trap a man into wanting to be in a relationship with you.
Yeah,
and nobody's up front in that model.
No, you're both playing. You're both role playing. You're playing characters. It's not the real you. So of course, eventually. When you get into the nitty-gritty of a relationship, you're going to see who you are when you're trying to choose schools for your kids or, you know, find out where exactly you want to live and why. All the things you share values and you don't share values on, and that's when the truth comes out. So it's no wonder that people don't. You get into a relationship, all of a sudden you go, oh boy, oh no, I didn't know who you were. You were playing.
Right.
You were misrepresenting yourself. You're an imposter.
Well, wait until couples start revealing their core sexual selves.
Oof.
You know?
Oof.
And suddenly, you know, wow, you know, I'm really, you know, wanting you to dominate me, and the other partner's like, well, no, I only want sex once a month, you know? And it's like,
yeah.
Wow. I wish couples would start out with who they are as sexual beings first.
And for us, that was really kind of the key. It's like, that was on the table. Sex is really important to us. It's a spiritual thing for both of us. It's really something that we want to devote a lot of our attention to, and that's turned out, you know, kind of devoting our lives to it. And because it was right up front, and because we didn't play games, and we were straightforward about it, it created a foundation where now, you know, we've continued that process.
Right. And then, you know, through time we realize that we each other has great characteristics, you know, compatibility enough, but your sexual self has to be reasonably compatible. It can't be perfect.
It's never going to be exactly, you know, exactly matched. Mm. I mean,
right.
And who would want it to be, right?
Exactly.
Boring.
Right.
The funny thing in all of this is that Brian and I have, you know, a wide range of people on, right? From political philosophers to you guys and all that sort of stuff. But what it always comes back to is trust and transparency. Like, what you're saying about sexual relationships is also true in what makes a society function, what makes anything function.
Yeah. But there's a difference, too, though, in that what you're touching on is the reason you move in with somebody, the reason that you marry them or date them, is exactly because you want to be sexual with them. And let's get even more detailed. It's because you want to get inside them, have them inside you, and put them in your mouth. I mean, let's get down to brass tacks, and that's
more detail, please.
Exactly, exactly, and you've got and that is what you put up with all of it for, man. You know, a deep, strong sexual connection is what I believe is crucial to the vibrancy of a relationship. And yet you have a lot of people that tell you, well, that fades and stuff like that. Well, if it fades, it for me, what the fuck am I doing in this relationship, right? I
mean, well, fading is the word that's problematic here, because it will change, right?
Yes.
I mean, the first 6 months or so, you're completely crazed in most cases. And that's going to shift into something that's not quite as intense. But if you don't maintain that connection, and actually, I mean, when you get into, you know, much older people who maybe can no longer have genital sex anymore, maintaining some measure of erotic connection, I think, even into, you know, 80s and 90s, I mean, I think that's really, really crucial.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, we're all going to face that. Our bodies are going to change, and they're going to function differently sexually. And, you know, that would be sad to say, oh, well, sex is over for me just because I can't get it up anymore, or, you know, be penetrated anymore, or, you know, that's silly. Yeah.
Well, and the interesting thing is Match.com does this survey every year about singles in America, and what they find is that for older people, sex is more important because they're not interested in having kids. They're not, you know, that's not on the table anymore. So, you know, it's really like the sexual component becomes even more important whether or not the equipment is working as they want it to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in retirement communities, they were having major problems with STDs because everybody was banging everybody, which is great.
And you have sometimes, you know, a very few males servicing quite a few females. So
I can't wait to get old.
There was recently an article, in, I think it was in the New York Post, about a retirement or an assisted living facility in the New York area where they had brought in some male strippers, and there was a picture of a very old woman tucking a dollar bill into a guy's underwear, and her kids sued or are in the process of suing the nursing home.
Isn't that sad?
Oh God, would you get it together, you Puritans? I mean, what is going on with those kids? How strange.
That's not my mother. She was a church-going woman.
Right.
She never...
Why do people have to ruin all the fun? It drives me crazy, man. It really does. I've always felt like that expression, I'm a pair of brown shoes in a black tuxedo world. You know, you just feel like, you know, come on, can we just, my joke is always that thing where you go to parties and everybody looks so good. Everybody takes all this time to pluck and tan and exercise. And it's just, LA is just, people are not wearing clothes and you're drinking and you're dancing. And after a while, you're like, is this going to be it? Are we just going to keep the cars in the garage or fucking orgy? You know, and everybody moves away from you. It's like, I'm married. I don't want to catch a disease, blah, blah. Blah, blah, roll the dice. Let's have some fun here. I mean, I'm being silly, but I do feel that way a lot of times. I mean, you know, and I think a lot of people do. But this touches on something I want to ask you guys about. I think a lot of times the reason people stop having sex is there gets into this weird thing of, well, you know, you need to be the one to initiate it once in a while. Or why am I always the one who has to initiate it? Or, you know, why can't you let things just happen naturally? And there are all these things that happen. So it becomes a power dynamic where sometimes in a relationship, the person feels as though if they do open up about wanting to have sex with their partner, they're in a losing position.
Wow. So, I mean, our answer to all that problem is to practice unspontaneous sex regularly.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about trying to move away from that, you know, one person withholding and one person demanding and that whole dynamic.
Right, that's bartering, that's commerce, using sexuality as a, you know, and...
So we want people to mutually decide to have sex. And that's what we mentioned early in the show, you know, put it on the schedule for the day or schedule it twice a week. And both of you decide that you're going to be sexual together in whatever way you want to be.
And don't wait to desire sex. I think that's really, really a bad idea. And what they're finding with studies with female arousal is that that desire for sex comes after physical arousal. So get things started and then, you know, the desire follows.
Yeah. And so if you're making the choice as a couple that you're going to have sex, you know, just let's say twice a week for the hell of it, you know, that and you're going to schedule it twice a week, what you're doing then is you're mutually deciding that it's a priority for you and that whatever else is going on, you are going to take that time. And that is a way of keeping sex it's not a matter of frequency. It could be 5 times a week, 7 times a week, or, you know, once every 2 weeks. It's not about how many times you do it. It's about the decision to make it a priority.
And actually, that's what you do when you're dating. Mm. You're just scheduling sex.
Yeah. Yeah, you are. Yeah, you are. That's right. You want to go out? Let's go out. Where do you want to go tonight? Really, let's get dinner out of the way so we can get to bed.
Right, exactly. So then now you're married, and all of a sudden it's supposed to be spontaneous.
Yeah, like, and that's another one of your myths. I mean, sex has to be spontaneous. No, it's there's nothing wrong with planning it. And if you have kids and you have a life, you better plan it.
That's for sure. That's for
sure. And take it when you can, right? Yeah.
Yeah, especially not just kids, parrots. Parrots are, they require a lot of maintenance. I had two macaws. I know all about parrots.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you may as well have a chimpanzee. I mean, in fact, kids are probably easier than macaws. It's unbelievable.
They don't chew the walls of your house.
Oh, my God. My parrot dismantled a table. I was like, are you kidding me? They're no joke. I had a parrot named Jezebel, a scarlet macaw, well, a calico, ooh, I think, and she would chase women. Some women were not allowed in the house. She would run at them. So that wasn't good.
She was jealous, Brian.
She was jealous.
You hadn't discussed with her your desire for an open relationship.
Well, there it is. By the way, I think some jealousy is fun. I think, what do you think of that? I mean, sometimes a little drama, a little jealousy, a little kind of like, what did you say? You were looking at her? You know, that kind of stuff. That you feel wanted, you feel needed sometimes. What do you think of that?
I mean, as long as it's manageable and as long as it's not, you know, I'm going to hit you for looking at my girlfriend kind of mentality. I mean,
right. Spank, you know. Spank and hit are two different things, but yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like the idea of you're going to get punished for being a little slut.
Okay, well, yeah, that's really working with it. Isn't it?
There it is. That's exactly. Not that I've ever said those words. Right? I'm just saying. God, I'm exposing myself for being the pervert of, you know. This is supposed to be, you know, a heady podcast, for God's sake. Look what you people have done to us. No,
we're out to corrupt the country.
God bless you. I think we need it. And I don't think you're out to corrupt the country. I think what you're out to do is have an honest conversation. And
I'm kidding.
But you've written a book about, you know, a large part of this book is this is exactly how people think but don't talk. There are still a great deal of taboos surrounding sex and what is acceptable in marriage, what is acceptable when you commit, quote unquote, to somebody. And they are strong and resilient boundaries, at least in this country. I mean,
it's shocking. We actually, we live in Westchester County, New York, and when Partners in Passion came out, we put up a flyer in our gym. And we got permission with the cover of the book, which is pretty vanilla, you know, nothing you wouldn't see on the cover of a magazine in a supermarket. We got permission from the gym to put it up, an announcement that we're having a little wine and cheese reception in the neighborhood. And we come back the next day, and the flyer's been taken down.
When we asked the manager, a couple of the parents complained, and they were worried their children might see the cover of the book.
And ask questions.
Oh, boy. Well, and you talk a little bit in the book about how a lot of indigenous peoples and older customs and tribes have hunter-gatherers. I mean, you see a lot of sex. I mean, kids grow up usually sleeping in the same. I mean, Jared Diamond, who we had on, sex is talked about a great deal. Children are exposed to sex, their parents having sex and things at a very early age.
Yeah.
So, but we do have this tendency to protect them. And I do the same with my child. I don't want my kids knowing certain things. It's natural to kind of figure out before they can. You need to help them put these things into context, because sometimes it can, you know, who
but
knows,
don't you right? also feel that it's partly the demands of being in a complex industrial society versus being in a hunter-gatherer society? Like, in general, in a hunter-gatherer society, people are often getting pregnant at 13, which we tend to think is not a desirable outcome.
Right.
Yeah. And I think probably is not, given the constraints of the world that we live in.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
But at the same time, I mean, the sexual current, sexualizing is sort of, it's only okay if you're being marketed to or, you know, sold some item and, you know, you're kept in a state of longing, or if it's presented with violence.
Right. I mean, it's perfectly okay to, you know, for kids to watch all kinds of violent stuff on TV, but God forbid they ask you a question about, you
loving,
know, love and sex at age 8 or 10. I mean, we're not really talking about
sexualizing a child, no.
Yeah.
No, of course not.
No, but I think that's the thing is, essentially, I think a lot of what you're raising is that marriage had a particular function in pre-modern times, which was, you know, dealing with infection where they didn't really understand where or how the infection was happening. Now we do, and there are things we can do to mitigate it. You know, there were specific functions to marriage in a historical context, and a lot of what we're trying to figure out now is, what is marriage? What does it mean to be in a relationship? And, you know, I think what's interesting is you're saying there are many, many, many ways to structure a relationship. The most important thing is to be upfront about it and to make sure that both parties are being totally honest about what they want and need so that it's consensual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And and that's, I mean, it's sort of, you know, there's enormous possibility in that because we are in a place now where even as opposed to our parents' generation, where it's really open and we can decide as individual couples what, you know, what kind of relationship we want to have and how we're going to structure it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we'd argue for is whether you're going to be monogamous or open, kinky or vanilla, that it's something that you decide upon and agree upon mutually.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, for me, it's all about what is the truth here? What's the truth of this subject? What are we really dealing with here? You know, and I think that if you want to make a relationship work, you better be honest with each other. And that is sometimes not going to be, maybe you might violate certain taboos you had to grow up with. But if you don't confront the truth of, let's, for as most importantly, as an example of who you really are and what really turns you on, if you can't really tell your partner that without feeling like this could really put the relationship into jeopardy and stuff, you're going to be now you're working from a lie. And I think if you and that's as big a sin as anything else, because
absolutely, and your relationship and your sexuality will suffer, because if you're pretending to be someone you're not, or you're suppressing some aspect of your sexuality, it's going to come out somehow.
Mm.
Right. And I think a lot of kind of compulsive sexual behaviors that, you know, get labeled addiction in some of the popular culture really have to do with something that's being suppressed and is expressing itself in an unhealthy way.
Right. You've got to hide it. And then the only way you get off is by, you know, hunching over your computer in a hotel room or whatever.
Brian, but this is hypothetically.
Again, I'm being hypothetical, guys. I'm being hypothetical. Well, listen, Mark and Patricia Johnson, Mark Michaels, Patricia Johnson, writers of Passion, Partners in Passion, A Guide to Great Sex, Emotional Intimacy, and Long-Term Love. I really enjoyed the book. I think what you've got to say has a lot of merit and value. I was ready for it not to, and I was pleasantly surprised by the book. So we're going to put it up on our website, and thank you for all your hard sex. I mean, hard work. your hard work.
We promise to continue.
I will let you know when I'm in your neck of the woods doing stand-up, if you let me know where the closest swinger party is. All right. So my wife can look at me and go, no way. All right. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks for having us.
I actually learned a lot. I appreciate it. Stay in touch. Bye. There they are. I've been looking at them. They're a good-looking couple. They're a good-looking couple. She was a, you know, an opera singer, and you know, again, they made it work for 15 years. So the book is Partners in Passion. But dude, I was actually ready for it to be a wishy-washy book, but I think they have a lot to say.
No, I think they really thought it through. I mean, they've gone through a lot of the research,
but they've also lived it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Hunter Motz and Brian Cowan bring you not just historical insight, but sexual secrets.
Which will also be the name of Brian's tell-all biography.
That's right.
Sexual Secrets.
Sexual Secrets.
With Brian Callen.
With Brian the Kid Callen. Why does he stay so young? We'll take a look at his dick. I didn't enunciate the k at the end of it. I just said his dick.
His dick. That's because it just goes on and on and on and on.
Exactly.
There's no ending to it.
That's exactly right. Well, anyway, guys, there it is. Hope you learned everything. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.